find myself fortunate to be here with you for yet another glorious week. You are my people. You're curious and interested in the world around you and how it works, or doesn't. You're smart enough to look for connections and new solutions to real problems. And you care about that circle closest to you, but also in concentric rings outward into the community and extending to our planet. If I'm being honest with you, it's been an adjustment for me in renaming this podcast. For those of you who are new here, it was Talk Farm to Me for 4 years, and now it's One Bite is Everything. It's taken me a minute to get into the flow of things, but the best way to develop a new habit is just to do it again and again. And what I've realized as I've been here, continuing to bring you new, fascinating people to meet, unraveling big, complicated issues, and making them actionable in easy ways, is this: one bite actually is everything. Stories are never simple and unilateral. They connect. Your small decisions ripple outward, knitting us together or tearing us apart. The more informed we are about what's important, the elements of life that fortify our health, our environment, our communities, and our economy, the stronger we are. Today is no exception. We will take one bite and unfurl the consequences, the truth, and open our eyes to a reality we all want to protect. You'll see. Let's start with Yellowstone. The award-winning television drama starring Kevin Costner as John Dutton, a sixth-generation rancher trying to protect his 825,000-acre Montana ranch from developers. With 47 episodes in 5 seasons and 3 spin-off series, it's fair to say that the nation has become swept away with the Yellowstone phenomenon. The storyline, the expansive and picturesque landscapes, the explosive drama, the family dynamics, and the sex appeal of Beth and Rip. If you know, you know. Today, we travel to Montana, into the shadow of the fictitious Yellowstone Ranch, and the Dutton family to meet the reality on the ground at Pintler Mountain Beef, where rancher Sarah Christensen digs deep into how farming and ranching is way more than just that. It's about the soul of the nation, the health of our children, the survival of our communities, and the nitty-gritty on how our economy works and can work better. Let's dig in.
Since 2020 and that Yellowstone phenomenon, people have been moving to Montana. To be able to afford a house in Montana now, you would have to make 77% more than you made in like 2019. What that translates is that, you know, it's kind of this fashionable place to live, and it's kind of an idea, it's a concept, but much of the rural communities or open space have been traditionally used for agriculture. Just where I'm located now, not where our family ranch is, was this 50,000 acre swath. Almost all of it was in production, I think like 30 years ago, and now not even 1% of it is. Now that land has been deemed appropriate for subdivisions, for homes, it loses all that agriculture value because there's no money inherently in it.
Since Yellowstone premiered in 2018, Montana has seen a surge in new residents purchasing land at an alarming rate, particularly farms and ranches, causing the value of land to reach an all-time high. People are moving to towns like Bozeman and Paradise Valley, drawn by the picturesque landscapes they see on the screen. Real estate prices are climbing as demand soars. It's not just about owning a piece of land. People come with an idea of embracing a rustic lifestyle with the charm of the Wild West. This influx of new buyers purchasing ranches and farmland is causing a significant strain on ranchers and farmers in the area.
And so it's hard to be like, well, we're holding out. We feel this is important. There's things that are more important than just money, because on our ranch in Phillipsburg, we have a mated pair of great gray owls, which are, you know, becoming more and more rare. I think they're close to being on the endangered species list. And you're like, if those all get subdivided into homes, what happens in the displacement of those animals? And you're like, am I ridiculous for thinking about that? Or is it reasonable and you're like, where do you fit in the world anymore? Because the values and the things that were taught to you as a child are no longer relevant in a very fast-paced kind of cutthroat society where you've just got to act. And oftentimes farming and ranching is a slow, very intentioned action that isn't sexy and or exciting.
I did watch Yellowstone. I didn't realize it was a real estate phenomenon following the show, but don't you think it's ironic, having watched it and all of the efforts to preserve ranch land, that the exact opposite happened?
Yes. I mean, I think we're experiencing a modern day land grab, but it's occurring with a few subset of people. Had we not inherited our family ranch in 2020, we may not even be able to hold on to it now, because I think inheritance tax is at like $13 million, because it's like, what, $6.5 million per parent. And then you pay capital gains taxes on what's ever over it. And we don't have millions of dollars saved. And I can understand the need, but there's such rapid price changes that are occurring in the value of land. But production costs, we're not making more on cows. Maybe this year, which is a phenomenon, but nobody's making more money. And so you're doing it based on principle. And I think the only tool that we have available to us to reduce that value of the land price is a conservation easement that does tie the subsequent generations of landowners of what's happening. But that's the only way for people to retire in multi-generational ranches. Because if you sell off a little bit at a time, eventually you don't have anything.
A conservation easement is a voluntary, legally binding agreement that restricts the development and use of a piece of land to preserve its environmental, cultural, or historical value. It involves a landowner selling the rights to future development on their property to preserve its conservation values. When a conservation easement is in place, the land is permanently protected, which generally reduces its market value since it can't be developed. This lower value can make the land more accessible to buyers such as farmers who may be interested in purchasing it.
And so it's hard, but I think that there is a shift, and I think that there is an opportunity. But we're having to kind of shift some of the old guards and how they want to relate to people and their food, how we relate to the next generation, and overcoming some ideas and egos associated with that. Like, I recently joined a growers co-op, which a third generation processor was going to go, needed to sell, and his children couldn't buy it out because the land was worth $2 million that the butcher was on. And so a group of ranchers knew that what was going to occur and how it would be a blow to our agricultural community, because it'd be one less slaughterhouse. And so they got together and were able to buy it. And so we are one of 40 families that have bought into this co-op. I hope that through this tumultuous time, if we as communities can come together and invest in one another, could there be a different outcome? But when that's spoken about, a lot of the responsibility is placed on the farmer and the rancher for education. And so something like what you're doing is very helpful, because providing a platform for people to be educated about what it truly entails to tend to the earth in the United States and bring that food to Americans' tables is really important in a time where there's trade deficits, at how only Americans are going to save each other. And I hope that might be something that connects us.
It's super interesting to me that you all came together, 40 families, to rescue this really important business element for all of you.
Yes, it's incredible. I haven't been in a room with people that believe so strongly about something. It was really awe-inspiring. I think people believing in what they're doing, believing in that, this kind of sounds silly, but that connection to the land, sir, is more important than all of the pressures that we're experiencing.
So talk to me about those pressures.
Okay, so here's an example. We were running some cows on a grazing allotment, and we weren't sure how to get our cows in because there was perimeter fences. And so somebody was like, we'll just hire some day cowboys to come out and who ride and help you bring in your cattle. And I was talking to another rancher and I was telling him about our problem. And he's like, where are you going to find those day cowboys? Because they're going to need a $50,000 truck to pull a $20,000 trailer, to ride a $10,000 horse, to put in fuel for, you know, $4 a gallon into that truck. And then their cost of living, they're going to have to be renting a $2,000 house, even in rural Montana. How much are you going to pay them? I can't afford to pay, I don't know, $1,000 to get my cows in. Price of cows have not adjusted, and the price of beef has not truly adjusted to all of the expenses for raising said animals. The other day we were driving, we were at Ace Hardware, which we don't necessarily buy a lot of our fencing materials there, but that's like our go-to for stuff. And I was down where they had T-posts. T-posts were $10 a post. How many T-posts could you use in putting up a fence? Thousands. And yes, it's an investment and they'll last for probably 10 to 20 years, but how do you even afford that? I mean, right now, are we getting incredible numbers on cows? It's expected that this isn't going to even last a year. So where do you recoup the money?
Explain to me the money here. I was talking to a chef recently who said, yeah, beef prices are through the roof. He has a meat restaurant, right? It's mostly beef. And he's like, beef has been really expensive. So what's going on economically that's making all of that happen from his perspective, from yours?
So it's kind of multifactorial. The issue that the producers in the United States have are the four large packing houses that result in 85% of animal production in the United States. What they're able to do is import beef from South America. I think for the United States, the primary import is from Brazil. And they're able to put a carcass in a compartment on a container ship and then ship that to the United States. Right now, they have removed where they can no longer say that this is from the United States. But to even get, I think, the United States, like American beef labeling, is not an easy process with the most recent legislation. And so it's very inexpensive. There isn't as much regulations. They're able to devalue the labor cost and the production in there and then bring it over and still sell that beef for less than what it costs for us to produce it. What ends up happening is I don't pay for my labor. I then reduce what I'm doing because I have to be competitive, because maybe that chef is saying he's spending a lot on beef, but he's still probably buying those ribeyes for $10, $12, maybe $15 a pound. I have to sell mine for $26 because I'm paying a butcher $1,000. They're paying the big four on average, which may or may not be coming in from a cargo ship out of Brazil. It's about $35 a head. And then they make the majority of their money off of the offal. So they take the offal and the reproductive organs, and then those are sent to China and to Japan, because I think like all of the reproductive organs are used for the ideas that these supplements will help with reproduction.
Offal refers to the internal organs and entrails of butchered animals, including parts like the liver, kidneys, heart, lungs, intestines, tripe, sweetbreads, and brain. In many cultures, offal is considered a delicacy and has a strong market demand. For example, countries with traditional cuisines that incorporate offal, such as France, China, and Mexico, can provide lucrative markets. It is also often less expensive to procure compared to prime cuts of meat, making it cost-effective for both sellers and buyers.
And so for us, part of my $1,000 fee is I have to pay for a disposal fee. I have to pay a slaughter fee. And it's heavily regulated how my animals are killed. So we've toured multiple USDA facilities. The person who ultimately butchers the animal only gets 15 seconds to do it in. But if you have a USDA or a state person watching each cow being slaughtered. They don't have that in Brazil. They don't have any of the oversight. You know, what's their withdrawal period from antibiotics on their meat? We're here in the United States. They have to have a certain amount of withdrawal period before those animals can get butchered. And so they have no regulations on how those animals are done. They bring them over and then they gain these systems where I have to then educate and connect people to the land and work my ass off to show the value of what I'm doing to just barely make ends meet and charge twice as much. And I'm doing it because I'm passionate, because I believe in it, because you can't put a price on the piece of land that we get to tend, that we get to be connected to, that we get to be stewards in our lifetime. You can't put a price on that. That is like soul work, but they're taking advantage of what our intention is and what our ancestors have done. The multiple generations that have been showing up on the same piece of land for it to come to us and to constantly push back and fight against a system that I think all parties of our political system have given up on. Because one wants to overregulate, one wants to sell the land out from underneath you. And like, I was looking at a pie chart of like global emissions. And how dare any politician come after agriculture when literally you look at the pie chart and it says 100 companies are responsible for 75% of the world's emissions. You look at that and it's like the first Google image when you look at like a breakdown of what are contributing to climate change. And so all of these educated people look at that same chart. It's a very common reference, and they have the gall to go after agriculture. Like, it doesn't make sense. And so you're like, it doesn't matter which party, this doesn't make sense. And then we are expected to teach, you know, like I'm doing grass-fed beef. So I'm thinking about like, I'm going to use diatomaceous earth on the back of my cows to prevent lice.
Diatomaceous earth is a natural product made from fossilized remains of tiny aquatic organisms called diatoms. It is commonly used in agriculture as a natural insecticide and for pest control. It works by causing insects to dry out and die when they come into contact with it.
I am going to look at what minerals they're doing to really clear out their rumen and to optimize their health. You know, all of this work, and then I have to prove, not argue or fight, but there is a sense of conflict to show that we are doing a good job and we are showing up and we're honest. And I think that we're patriotic because everything about what we're doing is an investment into our local economy. You know, like I think almost every single aspect of our beef is coming from American labor. From owls, our truck, our trailer, our side-by-side, our tools, our mineral, our feed is all coming out of the United States. And yet ranchers or farmers are vilified. And so what do we have to do with how we communicate and relate to the youth to be like, you guys are smart. Look at that pie graph. Does this make sense? You can tell which one's big and which one's small. And you can tell where it's coming from and which one contributes to maintaining grasslands in the United States, and the other comes from deforestation of the rainforest. And I think if individually I had a conversation with 1,000 different Americans like I'm having with you across all political lines, and I went through and explained this, I think that we could all agree on it. But it's like, why does that have to occur?
Why do you think that farmers and ranchers are being vilified? I haven't figured that one out yet.
I think that it is a talking point by big oil or big polluters. So the carbon footprint, that concept was brought into effect by oil companies. So you remove the responsibility and say, well, we wouldn't be producing this fuel if you guys didn't need it. So maybe you shouldn't drive to the grocery store. You should walk. But then we live in this life that's so busy. It's like, buy this. This will give you ease. This will reduce your stress. This will make your life more convenient. And I think it's grand manipulation with a few people that have immense resources that can manipulate the information. You've seen like commercials for immune disease on television. They're on the beach. They're dancing. It doesn't look so bad. No, it's a horrific autoimmune disease where you literally have to take a medication to stop your own immune system from killing your own body. And so I think that they have brought in incredibly smart sociologists, people that harvest our data and know how to manipulate the information that alter the way we think, because there isn't a collective group of farmers that have got one specific concept that they all push, where oil and gas, there's not a lot of them. And so they can get a consolidated message out there. And ag industry has been co-opted and been told to think and feel a certain way, which is kind of frustrating, because I want to point out, I want to say neither political party has been showing up for us, but yet we keep putting our faith into a set of people that don't care and never have cared. And this isn't about, in my opinion, the sexuality of other people. This isn't about where people are coming from. This is a few people that is taking from us and manipulating us into blaming our neighbors. And only thing that I could think of is there would have to be a union of farmers, of ranchers, of all American goods made in the United States that we band together and say, okay, we're going to trade at a deficit. I think this year the USDA predicted that it's really understated, $30 billion trade deficit with agriculture goods, which we are on the losing end. So we are importing more than we are exporting, but yet the imports set the price of our goods here. And so how is that not a gamed system?
The trade deficit for agricultural goods means that the United States is importing more agricultural goods than it is exporting. This places competitive pressure on U.S. farmers due to cheaper imports, potentially reducing profitability. This impacts their income and livelihoods, affecting rural economies reliant on agriculture. Additionally, it interconnects with sectors like food processing and transportation, impacting jobs and economic activity. Reduced profitability may discourage investment in agricultural innovation and infrastructure, further affecting competitiveness. Rural communities heavily dependent on agriculture face broader social and economic consequences, including population declines. Policy responses involve discussions on subsidies, tariffs, and trade agreements aimed at stabilizing farm incomes and supporting domestic production.
And my thing is that I keep coming back to is that it isn't the letter that's after the name. It's that we need to, as a people, say, this is collectively not correct. We have to put aside differences and say, where do we want, what do we want for the United States? What's important? And is it to control who people marry? Or are we going to allow a few people to determine what we get for our goods? Because they're able to manipulate the price.
Sometimes when I mention the idea of family farms and eating locally or just nationally or whatever, right? Draw whatever lines we want to draw around it. The pushback I hear is, oh, we have to feed the world. Why do we have that? We have to feed the world. And therefore, we're importing all kinds of, you know, maybe questionable beef from Brazil.
That's another way that people justify use of pesticides. Because we need to feed the world, we need to have our production value at a certain level. So therefore, this needs to be done because we cannot have any loss of a crop. I think, again, it's a manipulative tactic to put the onus on the individual, but yet we're not doing it. We're importing almost equally as much beef out as we are bringing it in. So I think, again, that is a narrative that's been manipulated. And I think it's been said so many times that people just accept it because, you know, we have a young rancher that runs cattle on some of our ranch. And that's what he said to us, because he's like, why are you guys doing grass fed? And we're like, because of the pesticides, because when like food grade goes to humans, but lower grades go to cattle. And the most modern practice has been they use Roundup as a desiccant, so they dry up the grain. Well, Roundup can break down and have a relatively short half-life, but it needs to be in soil with moisture, with other microbes to initiate that process. Roundup can have a half-life of up to, I think, over 200 days. So then if in how many years, if that grain isn't fed out, there's still Roundup in it. And so I think it's, again, another tool because it hooks the identity into the person of saying, well, we have to do it this way because there's a need. But it's kind of not true if they stop and they examine it. My observation is at this rate, if no breaks are put on, we're not going to have any land to farm or ranch. You know, maybe in certain regions, but here I foresee in the next 5 to 10 years, loss of a significant amount of ranches around us because all of these ranchers are in their 70s. Who's going to take it on? Who's going to take on a job where, yes, maybe you're in a house and on multi-generational land, but yet you can't make enough money to buy health insurance? For example, my husband and I, because we are multi-generational, so we have multiple people that own the ranch. Whoever is using the ranch has to lease it. And the lease is $30,000 a year, which isn't very high because it ends up paying for the bought water, which we have to pay for taxes, insurance. And so that infrastructure goes back in. And then for a family of five, like me, we would have to buy health insurance on the market would be about $30,000. So before we could even take home any money, we would have $60,000 that would have to go towards health insurance and just leasing the land. Would I tell my kids to come back and work this? I wouldn't. We have the opportunity to do it because I'm running 35 meat cows every year and it's a different operation. I have a different model that I'm running and my husband works full time. You know, and so then they're saying, well, you got to do it this way because if not, you're not going to feed the world, but that's really not happening. It's all of these mixed messages. But at the end of the day, all I keep observing is how do we economically continue to do this? I overpaid for a cow recently and I was really upset and I just was like, felt kind of slimy about it. And I was talking to my friend and she was like, it's okay to leave money on the table for somebody else. And that really spoke to me. You sometimes get this frenzied feeling of like, it's not enough. What do we do? What do we do? And this work by inherently is isolating. How do you check yourself? And it's the community. And then I feel like as the woman, that is my responsibility is the community, the connection, the love, the other aspect of it. And so I feel like I work three jobs. I'm mom, I'm a rancher. And then it's also constantly making connections because there is no town to just come and connect anymore. Everybody goes home and isolates on their phone or their TV. And so, and I think agriculture absolutely needs community to sustain. And so then you're like, you're putting all of this on all these small people to carry the emotional weight of what it means to raise food in the United States.
Tell me about your cattle and what your process is. You care very deeply, obviously, and you have reasons that you've decided to run cattle that are grass-fed and grass-finished.
So what we've chosen to do is we did cow-calf for 115 years. And in 2019, a lot of our old people were passing away or were in that phase transitioning. And so everybody needed to rally around them, help take care of them during this time. And we were also realizing it wasn't sustainable. Like at that time, hay was like 200, 250 a ton. And around here, you can feed for 6 months a year just because we can have snow on the ground for literally 6 months a year. And so we were paying these bills of $70,000 for hay, just these enormous bills. And we do have 130 acres of irrigated that we can put up hay. But if you're not able to go out, mow it, rake it, do all the things because you have people who are dying, it just can impact. And so we shipped it there and we brought in a cattle consultant and he was like kind of showing us all of these different business models. And one was, you buy people's opens. So what I do is I buy people's 3 and 4 year old open cows that have maybe given birth a couple times, but then either they have reproductive issues, something, and then we finish them out in the mountains above our ranch. Because where we are, we had to shift our business model due to the amount of snow we get. And so it was trying to create a business model that omitted having to feed out a bunch of hay through the winter. Right now, my ideal cow is 4 years old. And then what I do is I try and look at that cow and optimize its health. And so we don't use any porons. We don't use anything, but giving the cow the opportunity to make the choices to become healthy. So what I'm doing is I feed out more than 30 pounds a day. I feed out probably 40 to 50 because these are going to be beef cows. And then if I'm concerned about any pests, I'll use diatomaceous earth on them versus a poron. Not that I'm so concerned that the poron would absorb into the skin of the cow, but more so of if it kills the pests that are on the outside of the cow, it's going to do the same to anything that's in the soil. So the idea is that you're maintaining the health of your soil because you're not having any residual pesticides. And then we do no handling of them. We just put them out in the mountains, we round them up, and then immediately from the mountains, take them to butcher and giving them the opportunity to have to just be really healthy, to be under very low stress. And then with my mineral, I'm just doing Redmond salt. I put out a garlic lick if there's a lot of flies. I'm going to experiment with apple cider vinegar because I'm trying to understand the rumen and turning over a cow to kind of cleaning it out, what that means for my beef production. Because if they have a healthy rumen where a lot of feed is able to go in, they're going to put on weight. And I was able to have a gain of 2.5 pounds a day on each of my cows because I weighed them before they went out. And then I weighed them again when I brought them in before they went to the butcher. And then we are waiting and letting them eat the fall kind of natural graining where all of the wild grasses go to seed. And so strategically, I try to butcher later in September to give them a larger volume of time of when those grasses start to transition. And I have beef that's grading out to almost prime. And it has a much more rich flavor. And I think most of the cows in the United States are butchered by 24 months, if not sooner, especially if they're in more conventional feedlots. And the flavor of these cows developing, I have had such a positive response, but it also takes more time and money to get a cow to four. But our business model is absolutely built off of a healthy, strong, resilient cow-calf, because we need those people who are going to be like, oh, this cow isn't performing. We got to get rid of her. And she may not be a good mother, but it doesn't mean she's not a good meat cow. And so we feel like it has been working and goes well. And you kind of shift, though, from maybe I don't have a ton of cows from December through, you know, March. But then that's also when I'm selling that beef. So you kind of just trade your work for one to another. But what we've also been really trying to do is when people talk about nutrient density and the health of the cow, what that translates into ranching practices and how to implement it. And it's not easy. It's not easy because there is no handbook on this. This is kind of uncharted territories and you're picking up here and there, but it's hard to get a concise plan. And I also observe regionally, it can be different. I think just based on like Montana versus California versus Texas versus New Mexico, there's a lot of regional differences. So what may work for us isn't going to work for somebody else.
In the marketplace, people are very keen on grass-fed and grass-finished, which has almost become a buzzword. Can you unpack that for me? Like how what you do impacts people health. You're having healthy cows. You're bringing these yeah. to optimal health. What is that doing for consumers?
One, I think the buzzwords of grass-fed, grass-finished, you could then make the assumption that you're not going to have glyphosate or chloroquat in your meat because those pesticides and the half-life of those pesticides, that's in the meat. It's just not being tested. So I think that that is the appeal, is that you're in hopes of there isn't going to be those pesticides, because they're not generally spraying them on grasses. I think alfalfa will get sprayed some, but for the most part, you're not going to do it on just some regular old just grass out in the meadow that you're going to go and hay. And so I think that's the buzzword. That's the hope. And then as for the other ones, that's where it gets a little tricky, because there is this greenwashing, this kind of co-opting of, off of other people who do the hard work, and they put all of this investment and time into it. And so then these words become trendy or sexy or whatever, but then they lose their meaning. But for us, I love cows. They're fascinating. They're really interesting. And what I'm looking at it now is like, okay, we're kind of nutrient deficient as a species, right? With processed food, with how we've kind of bred nutrients out of our fruits and vegetables based on our agricultural practices. And so trying to bring that back in and giving our cows what they inherently know, which is they'll go out and eat what they need, provide them with the mineral, and give them an opportunity to do biologically what they do. But I'm also only doing this for 35 head. I'm not doing this on a larger scale, but if there was many people doing 35 head, it could fill that niche. But based on policies that have been introduced since the early 70s with agriculture, it's get big or get out, get big or get out, consolidate, consolidate, consolidate. When I have my people over to buy meat from me, they see where our cows are. We allow hunting on our family ranch in Phillipsburg because we'll have like 1,000 head of elk. So people see where our cows are raised on every level. And all I can hope is if people are critical thinkers that have curiosity and an open mind, are they open to hearing this, seeing this, and being interested? And also, I think people are wanting to connect with land, because as humans, we've evolved to be in a relationship with the earth, and that we've lost that. But I don't think that yearning goes away, that it gives people a connection through me. My passion allows them to feel that reverence and that respect. And that's my uniqueness for selling our beef, is my individual reverence and love. And hopefully that's something.
What would you like for a non-farmer, non-rancher to take away from this conversation?
One is, I feel better when I eat closer to my environment. I'm a living organism within this environment of Western Montana. And when I eat my beef, when I eat produce that are coming from the soil that surrounds me, I feel better as a human. I feel better because I am a symbiotic relationship with the organisms within me and everything around me. And so if they can tune into their body and see that benefit, I think that, like, on a personal level, that has helped me thrive. And then two, this sounds silly, and what comes to mind is, what do you want out of your life in the world? I just think we all deserve better. We deserve better, and we deserve good food and clean water and clean air to breathe. And the farmers, not the industrial, huge, crazy farming that's owned by some huge corporation, but the local farmers and ranchers that are producing food in your region, we're trying to be part of the answer. You know what I mean?
What a privilege it is to hear from Sarah Christensen of Pintler Mountain Beef, who shared her heartfelt journey and the significant challenges and triumphs of modern ranching. Today, we ventured beyond the picturesque landscapes of Yellowstone to uncover real-life impact of the show on Montana's land and farming communities. Sarah's story illuminated the delicate balance between preserving our agricultural heritage and adapting to a rapidly changing world. We explored the economic pressures that ranchers face, the importance of conservation, and the power of community cooperation. Sarah's dedication to sustainable practices and her deep connection to the land remind us that every choice we make ripples outward, impacting our health, our communities, and our planet. One Bite is Everything hopes to connect you to how tiny, informed choices can lead to big impacts. Today's conversation with Sarah exemplifies this perfectly. By choosing to support local farmers, understanding the true cost of our food, and appreciating the stories behind every bite, we can contribute to a more sustainable and connected world. Remember, each decision you make about what you eat and how you source your food is a powerful step towards building a better future. Whether it's through buying locally, supporting sustainable practices, or simply being more mindful about where your food comes from, every bite truly is everything. Thank you for joining me today and for being a part of this community that cares so deeply about our health, our environment, and our shared future. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, and sharing it with your friends. Your support helps us continue to bring these important stories to light. Until next time, keep making those small, impactful choices. I'm Dana DePrima, and this is One Bite is Everything.